Those who have fallen may remember the fall, even when they forget the height. Some such tantalizing blank or break in memory is at the back of all pagan sentiment. There is such a thing as the momentary power to remember that we forget. And the most ignorant of humanity know, by the very look of the earth, that they have forgotten heaven. But it remains true that even for these men, there were moments like the memories of childhood, when they heard themselves talking with a simpler language. There were moments when the Roman, like Virgil in the line already quoted, cut his way with a sword stroke of song out of the tangle of the mythologies. The motley mob of gods and goddesses sank suddenly out of sight, and the Sky Father was alone in the sky. Welcome to Pints with Chesterton, a podcast where two millennial women dive into the wonderful and whimsical works of Gilbert Keith Chesterton. I'm Grace.
And I'm Marie. On today's episode, we are discussing chapter 4 of The Everlasting Man, God and Comparative Religion. Hello, Grace.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. I am feeling like I'm back in school a little bit to be studying something every week and talking about it.
I know, me too.
But I'm enjoying that.
Same. I think this chapter was a little challenging for me at first. I felt like it was one of those Chesterton chapters where I had no idea where he was going until I did. Yeah. And it was like kind of near to the end of the chapter when I figured it out. So
yeah, I felt like this one was a little bit less of a struggle for me than last week.
Mm.
And maybe because he finally wasn't repeating himself again as much.
True. That's probably why.
This chapter was so great. He has such an interesting view of the history of religion.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought about some of the things that he says about religion until I read it in this chapter. This has been very eye-opening. This is all that I read this week, besides scripture.
Pretty much me too, yeah. Well, I'll say one thing. I have decided this summer to go through the Gospel of John, which I normally, if I'm going to read straight through a gospel, for whatever reason, I've just gravitated to the synoptics. I really like Luke a lot, so I've done that. But but I've never really, I mean, I have read John cover to cover before, but I felt like, I don't know, I needed to go kind of deeper, and I feel like John is the one to go deeper. So
yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. I'm just in the beginning now, but I'm hoping to kind of like making my way through that this summer. And then I have some kind of like, I don't know, classic summer reads that I like to read again and again. So I'm trying to decide which one to start with. But honestly, after reading this chapter, I was inspired to go back and read Thursday again. Even though that's not really a summer read, but since he's talking a lot about the Book of Job, which I'm excited to talk about in this chapter, but it's making me want to read it again. And I don't know, I might at some point pick up St. Francis. That's another one of my summer reads. And and then I really love Willa Cather's Death Comes for the Archbishop, just because of the scenery. It just, it feels summery to me. So
that is such a good book. Well, I decided to join you on the water train this week, but I'm having sparkling water with a little orange juice in it, and I added a cherry because
because you're an adult and you can.
I'm an adult and I can buy cherries.
I love it.
But are you on water too this week? Yes.
Yes. Cheers. I just have my Nalgene.
Beautiful. Cheers. So I have had. My experiences this week have been very domestic, and last night I wanted to study for this and write all my thoughts down, and I ended up doing laundry for 3 hours and cleaning the house and doing, you know, just doing all the things that needed to get done. But something has been eating part of my garden, which has never happened before. I have planted for, this is my third summer planting things here, and I'm doing the most that I've done, and something is eating all of the sweet pea plants that I planted.
Something like a bug or something like an animal?
I think an animal, like a deer or something. It has to be a deer because I have these high raised beds.
Mm.
So a rabbit couldn't be getting into them. They're like metal troughs. Anyway, and so I think it's a deer, but last night I just, in desperation, before I went to bed, went and I like put holy water all over that part of the garden. And I was like, Lord, please save some of my pea plants for Alexander. He really wants these to make it. And today there were nothing more had been eaten. So
hey, there you go.
I'm hopeful, but I'm like, do I have to go bless it every night? Or,
that's so funny. I feel like it's the natural order of things. Is that like kept away by holy water? I don't know. It's reminding me of our former pastor here who like our church building has gotten to be about 20-ish years old. And so things are just breaking like one after the other and whatever. And so, but at first it was just like, this is a few years ago. It was like, the roof like fell in multiple places, and then the air conditioning went out, which in Louisiana is like a very bad thing. And like just other things, like the lights were going out and the sound system went out, and it was just like all these different things. And he's like, I just kept like going around the church and like praying prayers of exorcism and like doing these things. And after a while, the Lord was just like, Andrew, man, your church is just old.
I love that. Oh, yeah, it's totally like, I mean, I'm one of God's creations, and that deer is one of God's creations and is totally, I mean, I can do nothing to stop it from eating my garden, but I really, I want some of the plants to make it. But anyway, that's what I've been up to this week. Just lots of good family stuff, some gardening protection, some Catholic protection of my garden, and reading this. And my kids were so sweet today. I was like, mommy has to finish reading. And Alexander just sat quietly near me aww, this like Marvel superhero book. And he let me read for about 20 minutes, which is, in toddler time, is like
forever.
3 hours.
That's amazing.
So what have you been up to this week?
I think I'm in still transition mode, just like into the summer months. So just kind of slowing down. I have been hit by allergies at a very random time, and I normally don't have them, but apparently there's something in Baton Rouge that is blooming late. So I've been kind of dealing with that and just kind of taking it slow. And then this Sunday I had just a bunch of Pentecost and graduation brunches and things going on. So just nice little social gatherings, I guess. So
that's really nice. Mm-hmm. We got a new bishop today.
Oh, actually. Wow. That's like big news. Who is that?
Yeah. Our last bishop just retired, and our new bishop is Bishop Battersby.
I feel like that's a very English name.
I know. Well, we heard it and I was like, oh my gosh, is it an English priest? Maybe. We couldn't make it over to his installment today, but it was happening today. And yesterday, Pentecost was amazing.
Yeah.
It was just full of special, I don't want to use the word energy.
well, you can use it in the like, Eastern Christian sense.
Yes. I mean, it was like the Holy Spirit was present. It was, the church was charged with the Holy Spirit. And we had somebody come into the church fully and receive confirmation, and it was just a beautiful liturgy.
That's awesome. We also had a confirmation. It was already Catholic, but yeah.
That's the best. I think that is such a special day to receive your confirmation.
Absolutely. It's like the day of all days.
Yeah. Well, let us begin.
Like I said, I feel like this chapter, I was a little confused in the beginning. So I think I figured most of the rest of it out, but I do want to ask you a question. I don't know if you were kind of following him, maybe better than me in the beginning, but he was saying something about human beings become less human by becoming less separate. We might say less human and being less lonely. And he kind of starts to talk about like human beings all squished together, like on a subway. He talks about like congestion rather than communion. But I wasn't really following what he was getting at there. Were you?
Yeah. I'm not 100% sure on this, but I kind of took from that what he sort of brings up in the last chapter, right at the end, when he's starting to discuss slavery, which we talked about in the last mm-hmm. episode, of how important the individual becomes in Christ.
Mm.
And like the in the body of Christ, nobody disappears like into the abyss. They still maintain their individual nature.
Yeah, because he says something earlier than that quote that I just read about like the religion of humanity.
Yes.
Or something, which, yeah. And yes. I think like the maybe the distinction between humanity and humans, like actual individual human beings. So, yeah, that makes sense to me, actually, the clarifying of the last chapter.
G.K. Chesterton says this in The New York American. I thought humanity would be a confusing sort of god. I thought of the Indian gods who have several heads and tried to imagine one with 100 million heads without much success. Mm. And even then it seemed to me rather cheek to worship this complicated person and then complain of the complexity of the Trinity.
That's pretty good. Yeah, so he's in this chapter, he's really taking on the idea of comparative religion. And he's not really, I guess, he doesn't really have an issue with comparative religion. He has an issue with the way it's often done, I guess, in university courses and things like that, which is to just kind of put all the different religions into a graph or into like a chart and just like list them and maybe their differences and things. But he wants to argue, I think, in this chapter that monotheism and then Christianity in particular, but he doesn't really get into it as much in this chapter, but monotheism as being something altogether categorically different than polytheism. Mm-hmm. But he says that polytheism is the thing, or paganism rather, is the thing that like has always been everywhere, kind of like, or maybe not always been, but has been, you know, for as long as we have, I guess, historical record. And that monotheism is this very strange, very odd thing that the Jews are tasked with kind of preserving throughout history. Yeah. And so I liked the comparison he made of paganism being like wine or cheese.
Yes, where it's like too.
It's like different all over the world and extremely varied, but at the same time it is the same thing, and we can recognize it as the same thing and as something very different than the monotheism of the Jews, for example.
So
he's kind of sets up this idea that he wants to talk about comparative religions under the categories of God, the gods, the demons, and the philosophers, which I thought actually will be helpful, but he doesn't get into anything except just the idea of God really in this chapter. And even just kind of, I guess, contrasting the idea of God with the gods. And I think that is a really helpful distinction, because when monotheists talk about God with a capital G, we mean something very in particular that is different than what other people mean when they talk about the gods. And these various pagan religions. So that was really mind-blowing to me, even just like when I was first learning theology and talking about like Thomas Aquinas's idea of God as like the very act of to be itself, you know? And that is something altogether different than like a big being, you know, or the greatest being that there is. It's like being itself. That's different. Yeah. That's in a totally different category. So I think that's what he's trying to draw out in this chapter, at least part of it.
Yeah, and he talks about in a couple places how even in the polytheistic religions or in pagan myths, how there's this hierarchy of gods, lowercase g, but then they all have this sort of simple and almost unacknowledged understanding of this being above all of that. And kind of like the sky father that you mentioned in the beginning. Quote.
I laughed at that, but I mean, it's very interesting. His idea that there's this, like, I guess the one God, this idea of the one God that we see in Judaism and Islam and Christianity, like that there isn't in the pagan religions, but yet it's like almost implied is what he's arguing, that there's like, he says that it's a void, but it's a void like an empty chair. Like there should be something there. There like kind of is meant to be something there. Or like he says the presence of the absence of God instead of the absence of the presence of God, which I thought was interesting. So like the presence positive of the absence of God. He's so good at like turns of phrases like that.
And they make the ideas so much more clear. I liked what he said about the sky, how he said we can look at a bird or a, what did he say? A bird in the sky. We can analyze a bird in the sky, but the sky itself is just so huge and looming and blue that we sort of take the sky for granted and we just focus on the bird.
Yeah.
It's almost like too brilliant to look at to be analyzing the sky.
Yeah. It made me think of the analogy that he gives. Was it in Orthodoxy? When he's talking about the boy who is like living on the side of a hill and he doesn't know that the hill he's living on is like actually the side of a giant.
Well,
because
no,
he's
in
like
this book.
Is it in this book?
In
the very beginning?
But I know. It's just, you guys, it's taken us a year and a half.
That was in the first chapter, I guess, or the introduction. Really, the idea of the giant, that the like boy lives on the side of the giant, is really the thing I was thinking about, because it's like, it's you're so close to the thing that you can't see the thing, you know, and both of those analogies are the same, but just like being so up close, like you were talking about the sky, like it's like so big that you just don't even, you don't even see it or you don't even think about it.
And you're like, it's just the sky. Mm-hmm. But he's, well, and it also reminded me too of like, was that in the quote that you read at the beginning? How basically even non-believers know that they're missing heaven just by looking at earth.
Because
like earth is so wonderful and beautiful and brilliant, and it is a signpost
in one sense. It's so beautiful that, but we yet like desire more, and then in another sense it's broken, I think, and we know that there's something from which we fell. Like we wouldn't have a sense of brokenness if we didn't come, if we didn't fall from something. There's something greater, simpler, better, more pure, that we were made for. And so he's implying like in all of the mess and the tangle of just the polytheism of a lot of the world, the history of the world, that there's this underlying like knowing that there's this one God or this one origin of all. Even in the mythologies, you kind of work back and back and back, and there's like gods that come from gods that come from gods. And he talks about it being like super, like getting more complicated as time goes on, you know, with all these different mythologies. And he's like, so the implication is that it came from something more simple, which was an interesting thought.
He mentioned the story of how Thor came to be, and you know, he doesn't tell the story, but he says, he mentions the story, and it's Thor kills his father. Anyway, his father ate all of his children, and it's like this crazy story, but it, you know, like Chesterton's point is that there's always this greater being and this division, and I almost think that people just enjoy the drama of stories, and and so the more fun parts of polytheism or paganism or whatever it might be, the mythology that they're telling as a part of their culture, that's what I thought of when he said, you know, they talk about their mythology openly, but then they go into the deepest, darkest, most private cave to acknowledge the simplest truth, which is like that God is above everything.
I thought that was so funny. He even, it made me kind of think of that too when he said, talking about like, okay, the one God that people acknowledged in the beginning and then kind of fell away from into this varied polytheism. He says, possibly the old God stood for an old morality found irksome in more expansive moments, which I thought was kind of a nod to today, like people devolving into a paganism or an idolatry because that old morality is irksome, you know. And then he says, possibly intercourse with demons was more fashionable among the best people, as in the modern fashion of spiritualism. And I was like, that's relatable as well.
I thought that too.
Yeah. So anyhow, there are any number of similar examples. They all testify to the unmistakable psychology of a thing taken for granted as distinct from a thing talked about. So yeah, people like to talk about what's fashionable, but the undergirding reality of all of it is not mentioned. But yeah. It also kind of reminded me of in the other chapter when he was talking about the cave, the cave drawings. Yeah. And yeah. People saying like, oh, like ancient man didn't have any notion of religion. But then he's like, yeah. But like if he did, then like if someone said draw religion, like how do you do that? You know?
I know.
And so
I know.
That reminded me of, that little example. But then also in this chapter when he's talking about the Jews then preserving this monotheism yes. and having this prohibition against images.
Yes. That was so interesting.
It was so interesting.
It says, as the Jews would not degrade it by images, talking about God, so the Greeks did not degrade it even by imaginations. When the gods were more and more remembered only by pranks and profligacies, it was relatively a movement of reverence. It was an act of piety to forget God.
Mm.
Yeah, the Jews were reverencing God by not imaging him. And I liked how he talked about how it would have made God into this sort of monster if mm-hmm. they had tried.
Yeah, well, and it would have made him just into another god among the gods, lowercase g, right? Yes. Because it would make him into a being that was like capturable somehow in imagery or capturable somehow in something smaller yeah. than being itself, you know, something limited, where God with a capital G is something unlimited, is something infinite. You know, and so, so I thought that was so beautiful. I had never thought about the whole idea of like the tabernacle or something. It's like, okay, or the Ark of the Covenant, like you have this box and like what's in it, like a couple of things yeah. that are representative of things that God has done. And it's like saying like that the presence of God dwells here, but you can't see it. You can't make a statue of it. You can't express it in any way except just to, yeah, believe and trust that the Lord is there.
Yeah.
And so that is so different, so different. And he wants to emphasize kind of like the craziness of the prophets of Israel amongst all of these like pagan priests and preachers, I guess. And I thought it was so fascinating too, kind of near the end of the chapter, he starts mm-hmm. to talk about how the tradition of Israel in that sense of like holding on to the monotheism and to this idea of God as totally other and totally transcendent and like unable to yeah. be captured by an image is in some sense only one half of the truth.
Yeah.
I thought that was super interesting. The tradition of Israel had only got hold of one half of the truth, even if we use the popular paradox and call it the bigger half. In other words, the more important half. It is important that God is totally other. But then he starts to talk about paganism and like love of locality and personality that's in mythology. And I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that he might be gesturing towards the idea of the incarnation later. And again, I don't know. I haven't read the rest of this book yet. So it's, I guess I'm going to find out. But I'm assuming that maybe he's going to make some point about Christianity being unique even among everything. Bringing this idea of monotheism together with the kind of immanence of God in his incarnation, and like being close to us and kind of taking on, humanity, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, no, I think you're spot on.
I was gonna say, what did you think of all of his stuff about, Job and,
oh yeah.
Right before that, was talking about God as the God of Israel as like the God of battles.
Yeah, I really appreciated that he brought Job into this, and it was clear again that it's his favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And he considered this to be, you know, one of the greatest contributions to literature of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it obviously stands over against the Iliad and the Greek tragedies, which is pretty high praise.
Yeah.
For the book of Job.
That's a big claim.
He says, you know, everybody says, oh, he was the God of battles, etc. But I liked when he said he battled for us.
Mm, mm-hmm. let's see. But an even stronger case can be found in the other criticism offered by the same critics. It is often said with a sneer that the God of Israel was only a God of battles, a mere barbaric Lord of hosts, pitted in rivalry against other gods only as their envious foe. Well it is for the world that he was a God of battles. Well it is for us that he was to all the rest only a rival and a foe. So meaning like to all the rest of the pagan gods. That he could battle for us basically to bring us out of that paganism.
Yeah. The thing that I found the most interesting about what he talks in this section where he talks about the book of Job is when he says the book of Job only answers mystery with mystery, but Job is comforted. Job is comforted with riddles, but he is comforted. Then he goes on to say, for when he who doubts can only say, I do not understand, it is true that he who knows can only reply or repeat, you do not understand. But then he talks about the sudden hope of the heart, that there is something worth understanding, that there's not just nothing. There is something worth understanding. The book of Job is hard for me.
Yeah, I think it's hard for everyone.
Yeah, but this made sense to me, though, that the way that he just said that there was a sudden hope in the heart, that there would be something worth understanding.
I understood that, I think, and I am understanding currently, just, yeah, I don't know, in the journey of faith and suffering and prayer and, yeah, wrestling with all these things, that's real. Like, I've experienced that before where it's like, oh, I don't understand. And then when I can encounter the Lord in such a way that he kind of puts me in my place and is like, yeah, you don't understand. Like, there is a reason, there is a plan. I can't explain it to you. You can't understand it, but like, it implies that there is something to be understood, it does kind of give this surge of hope, this supernatural hope that there's something more than I can see. There's something better that I can imagine. Yeah.
And that this isn't all just for naught.
Yeah.
You know, we're not just suffering. It made me think of my toddler because there are times when he doesn't understand why something is happening the way that it's happening or why we're doing what we're doing. And I say, I know you don't understand, but it's going to be okay. Mommy knows why we're doing it this way. So this is how we're doing it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, he wouldn't comprehend if I tried to explain some of these things.
Right.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, okay, Lord, I understand you.
I feel like toddlers, and I've been saying this for the last literally like 3 years of my life, but I feel like toddlers are just like an icon of like the inner spiritual relationship between us and the Father. Like, yes. I mean, they just really are. Like, they scream because they have so many big emotions and they don't even know why they're screaming. And I'm like, that's so relatable.
Yes, I know. They are us. Yeah. They are us.
Oh, that there would be something, a sudden hope in the heart, the sense of something that would be worth understanding. So I went through a thing a few years ago when I was writing, well, right before, I guess, I was writing that talk at the Chesterton conference, but I was wrestling with this idea that there was a reason for things. But I was afraid that the reason didn't involve like my personal good or like my personal the Lord's personal care for me individually, that like this idea that I could just be like a cog in the machine of like what the Lord was trying to do for, you know, the rest like of the world will. Or something like that. But in this line, something that would be worth understanding implies to me like no, there's,
it's worth it to
it's
you.
Worth it to me, like it's worth, like there's, it's both, and it's like, yes, it there's is the Lord's story and he has this big story and he's the star, but yet there's also worth of every individual human being. And I think that is the tension of our faith as Christians, particularly that it is the both and. It's like the imminent and the transcendent. It's the fact that God is so far above, so mysterious, so like unable to be comprehended, and yet he does care for each individual soul that he's created and like wants to fulfill each individual soul. So it's like this, both and without both of those pieces, it kind of falls apart, I think, for the human heart, and the human mind, you know? So anyway, I'm with Chesterton. I think Job is extremely important, and it's very interesting. I didn't know until I looked at the Great Adventure Bible study, that Job is one of the earliest books. It's set in the earliest times, and it was handed down from the earliest times. So in the like kind of chronological timeline of all of the books of the Old Testament, Job is set with Genesis. Wow. At the very beginning.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And so when Chesterton's talking about Job as this like great secret, he said, it is as if the Egyptians had modestly concealed the Great Pyramid. He's talking about how the Jews had sort of concealed the book of Job from the very beginnings of their people, like this story of this man named Job, like handed on from the very beginning. And yet it's one of the most like deep, complex, mysterious, confounding like books of wisdom literature that they have, you know.
Wow. Did you notice there were a couple Man Who Was Thursday references in this chapter? I just want to mention them before we finish. But he says sort of near the beginning of the chapter, the mysteries are true stories and are taken secretly, that they may be taken seriously. Indeed, it is only too easy to forget that there is a thrill in theism, a novel in which a number of separate characters all turned out to be the same character would certainly be a sensational novel. And it reminded me of all those policemen and the detectives and anarchists,
and also
around
Sunday and the man in the dark room. I thought of that, but I also thought of Man Alive with Mary Gray. Isn't that her name? Mary Gray.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's a good, yep.
Yeah. Spoiler alert.
And then later he says, it would be nearer to the truth to take the gigantic imagery of the Old Testament in which the prophet saw God from behind.
Okay. And so I was thinking about
Sunday.
Yeah. I was thinking about the Old Testament, but I didn't even think about Sunday. That's so good. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I when they're chasing him, it's just so funny. Oh man. When they're chasing Sunday, he's like this huge being.
Yeah. And he becomes like as big as the sky. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. Oh man, I think that's solidifying it for me. I need to go back and read Thursday this summer.
Yeah, this is your sign.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I really did enjoy this chapter. I thought it was he said a lot of important things about first paganism and polytheism that help you to understand that, like, especially with paganism for me, that there was something in paganism that then contributed later to Christianity. Like there were things to take from there. And then I also liked everything that he talked about with the Jews and like their journey. And I loved that he said that he says they're the most mysterious and the most reasonable. He says in the light of mythology, they're the most reasonable, and in the light of something, they're the most mysterious. Anyway, I thought that's so true, especially with the tabernacle and all of the cultural and religious customs and everything. At the end, he talks about nihilism a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
He mentions this Hindu. He says this Hindu tradition that gods as well as men are only the dreams of Brahma, and will perish when Brahma wakes. And then he said, we would call it despair, even if they would call it peace.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's important.
What did you think of? Yeah. What did you think of that?
Yeah. I think it's important because I think, and maybe I hadn't thought about it in terms of Hinduism before. I've thought about it in terms of Buddhism. Maybe like just this idea of like not desiring anything or whatever. And like this idea of like, oh, you'll only have peace if you can get to the point where you don't
disconnected.
Yeah. You don't desire anything. But I think that that's very inhuman. I don't think that that's natural to us as human beings, that that's actually what we're created for. And like Christianity wants a peace, but it's a peace that, that like Augustine says, rests only in God, in like in the infinite. So it's like the longing, the desire actually should be stoked instead of stifled. That it should be it should be made bigger, the desire and the longing that we experience as human beings, that does bring a suffering because we don't experience the fulfillment of it yet. That actually to stifle it is the opposite of what we need, but it's actually to to stroke it, to make it bigger, so that we can really rest in the infinite, who is God, who is a person, right, that wants an actual relationship with us. And that's I think what we really desire as human beings, is that relationship. So that
further up and further in.
Yeah. So this idea of peace as being just kind of a nothingness, like that's not very peaceful to me. You know what I mean? It's a peace sort of on the surface, but not underneath the surface.
I think it's people sort of trying to trick themselves, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, even just like the instincts that people have, that you would protect your family, that you would eat food to survive, that you would, there's like something in you, like all of these survival instincts that push you to do certain things and to like, you know, these innate desires in us that cause us to cultivate homes that are, you know, comfortable and safe. And if we have earthly desires for things like that, like C.S. Lewis says, then we have heavenly desires as well, you know?
Yeah, something there's even greater.
Yeah, that these are just little indications, that, like little signposts, but that there is something much greater.
Yeah, and I liked at the very, very end, as the last paragraph of the chapter, he says, "But if anyone fancies the contrast of monotheism and polytheism is only a matter of some people having one God and others a few more, for him it will be far nearer the truth to plunge into the elephantine extravagance of Brahmin cosmology." And I thought about the kind of like, I don't know if it's like the new atheist kind of argument of like, oh, I've only got one less God than you do or something like that. But again, it's like a mistake of like what we mean when we say the word God, that like it does mean something different categorically than the God. So you can't just say like, oh, monotheists just have one God and everybody else has multiple gods, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 million, whatever. But it's like, no, no, no. What we mean by that capital G God is like not another being among many. It's like,
Well, that was like his whole point of this chapter is like, you cannot compare Christianity with Islam, with paganism, with like, you can't put them into columns next to each other and then compare them. He says the parallels do not match up because Christianity is unique. It is the only thing like it. You can't compare it to something else. That's not how comparative religion classes are taught today.
Yeah. And I guess not in Chesterton's time either. I think we're good for this chapter. Do you have anything that you're particularly grateful for this week?
Yes. My brother Patrick and his wife Andy had their third baby.
Aww.
And since we last recorded, and she is perfect.
Aw, good. Good.
What about you?
I was just very grateful for the little Job references in this chapter this week. It really just like kind of brought me back to some of those foundational truths that I've been learning, over the last couple of years. And yeah, in the midst of, like I said before, transition right now from season to season, and it's like the summer months are very different than my rest of the year, being at a university. And so sometimes the transition is a little bit like, I don't know, it shakes the foundations a little bit. And I'm like, oh shoot, I have to kind of like shift into a different mode, and I don't know, it's kind of messing with my emotions a little bit. And so I just I really needed the references to The Man Who Was Thursday and Job and all of that this week. So I was just grateful for Job's lesson that God is a mystery, but he's not a distant mystery, but one that is like close and cares. And that I just can't fit him and his plan into my little boxes, you know, but that he's bigger than that and has a plan. I just don't know what it is. But until next week, may you all enjoy lives of wit
and whimsy.
Cheers.
Cheers.